Welcome to the Space Show, Eric. Now, do you think we'll go back to the moon?
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and absolutely. It's just a question of how soon. I'm 61 now, and if the NASA is able to stick to its schedule of going back in 2018, let's see, that'll get me into my mid-70s, and that's okay. I hope they don't delay too much past that, but you never know with Congress having to vote the money.
Yes, well, this is the point. President Bush has the Moon Mars Initiative. NASA recently announced how they're going to go about doing it. Do you think they'll actually stick to that?
It sounds like a pretty, what I've seen of it, seems like a pretty reasonable and effective use of present resources to be able to do it. It's a return to the Apollo philosophy in terms of the spacecraft in a lot of ways. I think we've learned a great deal from the shuttle, in part things not to do. And with new materials and new technologies, we should be able to return to the moon without spending as large a percentage of the national budget as we did during Apollo, even though it wasn't huge in those days either.
And what's the feeling in the United States, particularly amongst the people you meet, as to whether this will actually happen?
I haven't been to the States to talk to people very much about this. I retired to Australia in 1999. What I read is I don't see a great deal of complaints. There's hasn't been a lot of opposition in Congress. They have wanted to see the plans, wanted to hear about it, wanted to have some reasonable budget numbers, and I just don't see the media getting excited or presumably if there were significant numbers of people who were upset by the prospect, some of the politicians or the media would pick up on it, and that just doesn't seem to be happening. So I'm very cautiously optimistic.
And when we do go back, will it be just short-term stays like Apollo, or will we be there to stay, to set up moon bases and things?
Well, I certainly hope it's going to be going back to stay relatively quickly after the initial returns. Once we get some infrastructure in place, once we have a regular series of missions, I think things can proceed along steadily without drawing opposition and start generating some interesting results. One of the things that we want to do, of course, is to see if we can find some usable resources, particularly water. Some of the permanently shadowed craters in the South Polar and North Polar regions look very promising, although we've got a lot of work to do between now and 2018 to see if there's actually water there. It's just hints at the moment. And if that turns out to be true, then that changes everything, because it means in the long term we can start making fuel for the trip home, and that means costs of launch from Earth go down. But it's a matter of committing to a permanent return, which I think is in the cards, and then learning the things that we need to learn to be able to do that in an economical way.
Do you see any parallel between settlement of the moon and the early European settlement of Australia?
My first trip to Australia in 1986 was because of that possibility. The moon is an intriguing place, but it's very expensive to get to, and someone had mentioned to me Australian historian Geoffrey Blainey's wonderful book, The Tyranny of Distance, which is concerned with the impact on the early development of European settlement in Australia of the very high cost of bringing people and goods out from Europe or even from India later on. Settlement in Australia initially was, as everybody knows, started around the prison colony at Botany Bay or at Sydney Harbour. The intriguing aspect of the prison colony in Australia was that members of the military corps, of the civil administration, came out here, as Britons did in many parts of the world, to make their fortune. And they had an income as civil servants or as military officers, and they were able to use the sterling that they were paid to buy goods that were available from passing ships. Say whaling ships coming out from New England would bring rum, a lot of it was rum, but lots of other things as well, on speculation, basically, to see if they could find customers. The folks with money were able to buy it and sell it on to whoever, to prisoners on tickets of leave. They were also able to use this import capacity, which is basically what it was. The sterling gave them the ability to import things, so they were able to build up their own businesses. Eventually, John MacArthur in the New South Wales Corps, of course, started out in mutton and then got into wool in a big way that really got Australia cranked up in later decades. But it was people being able to support themselves in Australia because of using the base of that sterling that they were earning from the British government or from the penal settlement to get themselves established. And I think as we get a permanent presence on the moon and that permanent presence grows, it will eventually make sense for some people to become more or less permanent residents. And if we can set things up so that they have an import capacity, that their pay, part of their pay, is not dollars or yen or what have you, but is the ability to bring in tools, raw materials that aren't available on the moon. Now, of course, there will be other things that may get a lunar economy started. One of my favorite aspects of the whole Australian thing is there was a captain of Marines named Watkin Tench who wrote a wonderful book called 4 Years at Sydney, which was a bestseller in England after he returned home. And he writes that on the trip out to Australia, when they stopped at Cape Town, which was a refueling station or a refreshment station for ships coming out from Europe to India, okay, Tench thought that perhaps Sydney might be able to make its living in much the same way that Cape Town did. No one had any idea that merino wool was going to be the engine that drove the growth of the New South of the Australian economy. No one knew that wool was going to enable the Australian economy to become independent of the prison settlement, which it eventually did. And we have no idea what the long-term basis of the lunar economy is going to be. In the beginning, it's going to be a science base. It's going to be a research and a research facility, basically. But eventually, there'll be a way. They will find a way to make a living and support themselves, make their way in the world.
Well, how did your interest in the Apollo moonwalks develop?
I came to Australia in 86 because I was interested in the question of how a permanent community on the moon might come to support itself. And I realized that I didn't really understand what was involved in getting work done on the moon in a physical sense, and decided to dig back into the transcripts of the lunar missions that we've done and realized that nothing had been done with this incredible resource. And having read the Journals of Captain Cook, edited in the 20th century beautifully by a New Zealand historian named J.C. Beaglehall, I thought that it might be a good idea to do something similar with the Apollo transcripts. Hence, the Apollo Lunar Surface Journal, modeled unashamedly on Beaglehall's magnificent Journals of Captain Cook.
So what is the Apollo Lunar Surface Journal? Exactly, what is it?
Well, it started out as four 800-page books, but I couldn't find an academic publisher willing to undertake such a project. So it's a website. The web was coming along in the mid-90s, just about the time that I was looking for a way to get this work out into the world. It was a perfect mesh. So there is a website, www.hq.nasa.gov/ALSJ, for Apollo Lunar Surface Journal, and there you will find it.
Now, why wasn't this work done during the Apollo program or in the years immediately after? Why did it have to wait so long?
In the early 90s, when I was working on this project and had the privilege of sitting down with 9 of the 12 moonwalkers and going through their time on the moon on a minute-by-minute basis, we often talked about what a shame it was that nothing was done at the time. Like a lot of organizations of its kind, NASA has a fairly short-term viewpoint. Their focus is on the next mission. The last mission was accomplished, lessons were learned, those are incorporated in the upcoming mission. End of story. So it just took a while for somebody to think it was worth doing.
So what have you know? There has always been in the public domain the transcripts of what was said, the exact words, and so on. How have you extended that?
As I mentioned, I've had the privilege of sitting down with 9 of the 12, and we've gone through the missions minute by minute with a tape recorder, and listening to the mission tapes or watching the video, reading the transcripts. And if we got to a place where the astronaut thought that something needed to be explained, or he was reminded of something that had happened in training, or more often, I was puzzled by what was going on, we'd stop and talk about it. And most of that material has been transcribed and added to the journal. Since I released it on the web in 1995, I've accumulated this incredible group of people who are as fanatical about the Apollo missions as I am, people who are really dedicated to telling the story and getting it right. I have this incredible group of volunteers who have digitized background documents and photographs and lots of other material, and the journal has been growing for 10 years and continues to grow at an astonishing rate. We aren't far from done, but I think if anyone is interested in understanding in detail what was done on the moon, why it was done, how it was done, we've got it in there.
Can the astronauts still remember 35 years later the detail of what they did? I mean, has it so much burned into their memories, that those few brief days on the moon, that they can still remember it 35 years on?
In the beginning, when I first started this project in 1989, talking to Jack Schmidt, the geologist who flew on Apollo 17, his memory was certainly quite fresh. I learned early on that with him and with all of the others, it always bore checking things that they said against other evidence, the documents, against the video, what have you. But generally, in those days, their memory was very good. In recent years, of course, we're all getting older, and I'm finding it less and less productive talking about details. Sometimes they surprise me and have marvelous recollection of some particular subject, but the memories just aren't as fresh in 2005 as they were in 1992.
And hence, you know, the pity that this wasn't done in the 1970s.
Exactly. And it is my fond hope that when we go back to the moon and when we are thinking about going off to Mars, that something like this will be done, if not in real time, then soon thereafter, so that we can preserve these pioneering experiences for future generations.
And of course there's the parallel project with spacecraft films, isn't there?
Indeed. There's a fellow named Mark Gray in Virginia who has dedicated himself over the last several years to finding the highest quality material, video, audio, and the like, mostly in the National Archives, and producing DVDs that are now available on his website, www.spacecraftfilms.com. They're priced reasonably, and it's a stunning, stunning collection of material. I used a set of videotapes that were put together by a geologist named Larry Haskin in the late 80s and early 90s, just about the time I was getting started with the journal, and it was a godsend to have those tapes. But the work that Mark Gray has done in producing the DVDs has expanded the amount of material that we have available enormously, and it's a great help.
And now, of course, we've got this new IMAX movie, Magnificent Desolation. What's been your involvement in it?
I got an email from some guy named Tom Hanks back in February of 2002. I certainly knew and loved his work on Apollo 13 and on his 12-part series for HBO called From the Earth to the Moon. And he said that he wanted to do an IMAX film that was focused on what the guys did on the moon, which hadn't been done in great detail in From the Earth to the Moon. So knowing the quality of Tom's work and his commitment to doing things right, I was delighted to participate. And over the last 3.5 years, fed them ideas. They were kind enough to let me read a draft of the script and allow me to comment on it. And, it's been great.
Do the teacher job.
Well, the key players in the production of that film got themselves up to speed on the Apollo missions pretty quickly. They were pretty knowledgeable, and Hanks himself is a fanatic. He knows it in good detail, but. Yes, I was able to help and delighted to be able to.
So what are you trying to achieve with the film?
The basic aim is to get kids excited about space. When I was growing up in the 50s, the Walt Disney Organization did a series of films on space exploration with help from Wernher von Braun, the German rocket pioneer. And I thought those were just wonderful when I saw those when I was about 10 years old, and I'm sure had a major impact on my lifelong interest in space exploration. And so we hope that Magnificent Desolation, Walking on the Moon, will do the same for a new generation of folks who will help get the next phase of space exploration underway.
And what was Apollo 15 Commander Dave Scott's role in the filming?
Dave Scott has had a close association with Tom Hanks and his organization over the last several years, of course. He was a technical consultant on Apollo 13. Jim Lovell was initially to do that job, but something came up that he was unable to do that. Dave jumped in, had a great time, was able to help, continued in the same role as a technical consultant on From the Earth to the Moon, and has done it again for this film. on the Magnificent Desolation website, which is, I think, imax.com/Magnificent Desolation, all one word. You'll see some pictures of Dave with the actors in the mock-up of the lunar module, going through the script and showing, you know, which buttons you push when and why, helping them get it right.
Okay, now come down to Raftown Street here at the museum, bought my ticket. I'm now sitting down, putting on these 3D goggles. What am I about to experience?
It's the best job that anybody has done yet of capturing the experience of being on the moon. Now, I will have to admit that I've not been there, so I don't know what it's really like. But I've been through the flat video who knows how many times. I've talked with the guys who've been there. I've studied it in detail because I love it. And it sure looks real to me. With the technology that's available right now, it's the best anybody's that's done. And it's a good story, too. It's a very moving film, and I'm very proud to be associated with it.
I started noticing about 5 years ago, and it's been happening, you know, every few days since then, is people ask me, do I believe that they really landed on the moon? Now, what do you say to people who might doubt, 3 decades on, that the moon landings really did happen?
The first and most important answer to the question is, think about the rocks. The guys brought back hundreds of pounds of rock that geologists have been studying now for 35 years, getting PhDs, building research careers on understanding what those rocks tell us about how the moon came to be the way it is now. And they would not be fooled by something that somebody made in a laboratory to fake it. We have samples of genuine moon rock from the Antarctic and that were blasted off over in recent times, and it's the same stuff. Not to mention the fact that the 12 guys who've been are incredibly capable individuals. Are capable individuals, they are not actors. They've been there. They have had an experience that I would love to have, and when I talk to them, they take me back. And hopefully we've captured some of that in the Apollo Lunar Surface Journal, but if they hadn't been there, I think it would have showed. The arguments advanced in favor of the missions having been faked really don't stand up to the light of day. They're based on a misunderstanding of how photographs work. For example, they say, why aren't there any stars in the pictures? Well, if you take your camera outside on a dark night and take a picture of yourself standing under a streetlight and expose the picture for the right amount of time to show yourself, you won't see any stars in the background because the shutter wasn't open long enough. To show stars, the shutter has to be open for a long time, and if you leave the shutter for a long time, you're going to be a great big blob of light in the foreground. The guys were up there to take pictures of moon rocks and moon mountains and spacecraft and themselves saluting the flag. And no, of course there aren't any stars in there. The shutter wasn't open long enough. All of the arguments eventually fall to rational argument. And then the other thing is that there were 400,000 people involved in Apollo. Many of them were involved day to day during the missions. And unless they all are part of this conspiracy, somebody has to have scripted details not only of what the guys said, not only what the guys did, but the signals coming out of the spacecraft, how the suits looked when they got them back, all those sorts of things, to fool thousands and thousands of very capable individuals who've been devoting their professional lives to this for years? No, I'm sorry.
Well, thanks for joining us, Eric, on the Space Show.
It has been a pleasure, Andrew. It's always fun to talk to someone like yourself who's excited about these things as I am. And I hope that some of your listeners will go see the film, especially some of your younger listeners, and get even more excited about space than they already are.
Thank you.